You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
I'm going to open things up tonight, just to kind of get us thinking about things, with a poem by Mahmoud Darwish, who is a Palestinian poet. It's called "The Earth is Closing on Us," and it's from After the Last Sky. And it reads, "The earth is closing on us, pushing us through the last passage, and we tear off our limbs to pass through. The earth is squeezing us. I wish we were its wheat so we could die and live again. I wish the earth was our mother so she could be kind to us. I wish we were pictures on the rocks for our dreams to carry as mirrors. We saw the faces of those who will throw our children out of the window of this last space. Our star will hang up mirrors. Where should we go after the last frontiers? Where should the birds fly after the last sky? Where should the plants sleep after the last breath of air? We will write our names with scarlet stem. We will cut off the hand of the song to be finished by our flesh. We will die here, here in the last passage. Here and here our blood will plant its olive tree." And I started with this poem because it speaks about loss and exile and the loss of selfhood and what will be left around when everything is gone. And I was reading a book by Steven Pinker called The Better Angels of Our Nature, where he argues that we're a lot less violent than we've ever been, due to archaeological evidence. And I wanted to explore this concept a little bit by exploring this idea of violence and asking the question of the wonderful guests tonight, where do they think we are with violence today? So here with me to discuss this topic, we have the executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. He's an activist and author, Youssef Manayer. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming all the way from Washington, D.C. to be with us tonight. Also here, the professor of government at the LBJ School of Public Affairs, author of Welcome to the Poisoned Chalice, the eminent economist, Dr. James Kenneth Galbraith. Thank you for coming on. So I've already said too much, so I want to kind of open up the conversation with you guys and just talk first a little bit about how you're coming to this topic of violence, and what are your thoughts as we begin this discussion tonight?
Well, first, thank you for having me here this evening, and thank you to everyone who is attending and listening to this program. And I appreciate very much your opening with the poem by Mahmoud Darwish. Mahmoud Darwish, for those who are unfamiliar with him, was a Palestinian poet. I am also Palestinian. And for him, he's the most renowned poet among Palestinians, and he was known as the poet of the land, not of sort of the land in sort of like the national sense, but of the land itself, the physical land. And so the themes that you hear in this poem are found in much of his poetry, the connection to the soil, the olive trees, the relationship between the people's physical presence and the cultivation of the land is something that resonates very much with Palestinians, many of whom for centuries were peasant farmers, and for whom the agriculture of the land was really their lifeblood for centuries and continues to be to this day. And also, of course, the theme of exile, which is central in this poem and central in much of his writings, and of course a key theme in the Palestinian historical narrative. So, you know, when I think of the question that you pose about whether or not, is that better? when I think about the question you pose about violence and whether or not it is more prevalent today than it was before, I'd be interested to read the argument. I can certainly imagine moments in history when we were seeing far more violent times, explicitly violent times. But I also think that we as a human society have become a lot more sophisticated in the ways in which we communicate violence. And the systems of violence which exist today are more nuanced than they have been in the past. There's certainly a lot of very brutal, straightforward conflict that is still going on across the world. But the notion that we are less violent, for me as a Palestinian, for me as a minority in this country, and witnessing a lot of the brutality that takes place in this country, that minorities face at the hands of police, immigrants face, Palestinians face at the hands of security services in occupied territories, It's hard to say that we are a less violent place today. I think violence is communicated in different ways and more complicated ways in different contexts.
And Jamie, what about you? What comes to your mind in this idea of violence being communicated in different ways in different contexts?
Well, let me say first, I'm here in a couple of capacities. The most important one this evening is that I'm the fellow who's responsible for bringing Yusuf Munayyer to Austin, so I'm very happy about that. My own connection to these issues goes back quite a long ways. I started my adult life as an anti-war activist in the late 60s and 1970s. And for 20 years, until just recently, I was the chair of the board of an organization called Economists for Peace and Security, which brought together those professionals in my area who have a concern with these questions, including people who were, on the one hand, old anti-war activists and others who had been deep in the security establishments and who understood such questions and worked on such questions as the balance of nuclear power and nuclear threat. And so to get to your question and to the issue raised by Pinker, I think that one might make the argument that in past times, the presence of violence was an immediate and daily issue with which people had to contend. And of course, it manifested itself in many ways, including the fact that people didn't live very long. There was conflicts over resources are much more intense when resources are scarce. And that aspect of violence, seems to me, has receded to a degree in many parts of the world, not everywhere. But it has been replaced by, in every development of technology and society, a manifestation of violence, which is adapted to the kinds of developments that are going on, or that in fact drive the developments that are going on. And we can go back to the development of mass production, which was largely done to facilitate more efficient production of firearms. And in the 20th century, the mechanized violence on a vast scale, which enabled the extermination of millions on a fairly rapid basis and over broad fronts of open conflict. The nuclear age, which created a potential for the complete eradication of the planet that never existed in the in the times that Pinker's referring to, cannot be compared qualitatively with a violence that affected individuals but had no effect on the ecology of the planet or the survival of the species. So we're now in that position. And we're now, if you think about it, leaving us, we're still under the nuclear threat, but we are also in the process of digitizing the application of violence, of making violence and intimidation, surveillance, which is a form of psychological violence, something which is targeted to, can be targeted very precisely on individuals and in ways which it's extremely hard to detect or control. So it seems to me that far from having, there's no metric which says that this is a single valued variable which gets greater or less, but that we live under forms of violence which are very grave and which we need somehow to come to grips with as in sense central determinative phenomena. And that speaks to the societies which are for which this is a day-to-day issue and others for which it isn't. But it also seems to me to be the case that societies which have reduced the levels of violence internally have a certain responsibility for displacing it on other regions of the world. And Youssef was saying earlier today that the Middle East is the target of what some very large share of the world's armed flows and about 90% of the world's refugees. Why is that? Well, it's because we have we of the rest of the world are acting out the conflicts that we choose not to have on our home territory because we think the costs would be too large or the tolerance for them would be too low, on the turf of other people and creating other victims than ourselves. So that seems to me to be all part of the kind of matrix of issues that we're trying to come to grips with here.
Yeah, and a couple of the themes I want to pick up on. One of them is this idea of the land, of memory, and of one's story being a part of the way in which we negotiate forms of violent behavior on one another. So who has access to memory, who has access to the narrative, to the story. Can you talk a little bit about that, Youssef, in terms of what's happening in Palestine, in Israel, in the Middle East right now, and the importance of those stories and that connection with the land?
So, you know, for Palestinians who are still today a stateless people, the condition of statelessness, it's hard for many of us to really sort of identify with if we're citizens of the United States or citizens of wherever else. To be a citizen of a state means you have the right to have rights. And that there are certain protections and certain privileges that status grants you. And so for Palestinians who are stateless, what they are essentially denied is the right to have rights. And the way this manifests itself through Israeli state policies over the lives of Palestinians who live both in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip as second-class citizens inside Israel and as residents living as refugees outside of the homes and villages that they were from in refugee camps in surrounding countries involves various forms of violence. The reason that that is the case is because the enforcement of these policies requires the use of violence. If you are going to forcibly evict and demolish the homes of Palestinians in Jerusalem, for example, or elsewhere throughout the occupied territory, which is not an uncommon occurrence by any means, the people living in the house are probably not going to leave or accept that voluntarily. This requires violence. If you are going to arrest children who are suspected of throwing stones at Israeli soldiers at 3 o'clock in the morning in the homes of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, again, not an uncommon occurrence at all, but something that happens very frequently throughout the week, sometimes many times in the same night, the parents in these homes are not likely to give up their children voluntarily. This requires violence. And so the constant holding of a people in a status that is below the minimum that we expect necessary to be afforded to human beings around the world is a condition that is naturally going to be rejected by people in that position. Maintaining order over that requires violence. And this is how we see it played out in the lives of Palestinians on a routine basis. There is no independence or sovereign entity which permits them the right to have rights. And so that there is no defense against this violence. That is how, as Palestinians, we see our relationship to these policies, and we see often very brutal interactions with political violence.
I think that, and also I think Hannah Arendt refers to this status as a state of exception, you know, where the refugee doesn't really belong kind of anywhere. And that has, that negotiation of statehood, of selfhood, has been something from the beginning of the state of Israel that has been part of an identity on both sides. So talk about, you know, going back to that, the original conception of the state of Israel, and why you say, well, we have to go back to this point in order to understand where we are today. Why don't we go back to that point? You know, why is the discussion about history obfuscated, and why is there contestation about the beginnings and the origins of that space, and to try to get at some actual real peace between the two?
Well, it's great that you bring up Arendt in this context, because she had actually done some amazing writing and grappling with these very issues. She is, of course, very well known for her writings about the origins of totalitarianism, the focus on anti-Semitism and imperialism, and wrestling with this question of Jewish identity in Europe. And what was the way in which that question should be resolved? And really the question of minority rights in society. So it is not a, it's not a particularistic question just facing the Jewish people, but really a universalistic question about how do we incorporate minorities in society, or how should we incorporate minorities into society. What is less known about Arendt is some of the really fantastic writings that she did in the late 1940s, specifically around the questions of Zionism and the creation of the State of Israel and what it means. And she was actually very critical of Zionists at the time, and understood that the creation of the State of Israel in a way that resulted in this mass depopulation of Palestine, and I'm paraphrasing her words here, but it's very close, resolved the issue of one stateless people only to create it as a problem for another stateless people. And therein lies the crux of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. You have this question of land and two peoples and this demand for some sort of exclusive ethnic control. And if that is going to be the outcome, then one of these two people are either going to have to leave or they're going to remain and be victorious. That is a zero-sum situation, which is going to breed conflict, which is why I think it's so important to talk about the origins, to talk about the creation, and really ask about how are the ways in which the impacts of the creation of the state, the creation of this refugee problem, can be addressed in a just and equitable way to move us closer to a peaceful outcome.
And then, you know, Jamie, you brought up something which is, well, here we are on the other side of conflict. You know, we're not perpetuating these types of violence among ourselves, but look at the effect that they're having abroad. Talk a little bit about some economic ways in which the United States, economic and political, in which the United States has narrated, is this okay back there? Has been involved in these conversations, but not they're not, we don't want them directly to affect us, but we've been involved in the conversations.
Well, let me do a couple of things. So before I get to that question, I had another thought which ties into what Yusuf was just saying. after his talk at the school earlier today, we walked through the LBJ Library and Museum, and particularly through the exhibit that covers the period from the Civil Rights Act through the Voting Rights Act. And it strikes me that this question of bringing people into a state and giving them the full benefit of citizenship, something that's very much, of course, part of our own history, and it was that period was the defining element in that struggle. And it was part and parcel of a process that involved initially, and in a continuing way, a great deal of violence inflicted by white people on black people seeking to establish their rights. And the de-escalation of such violence is, if it is successful at all, the product of an effective establishment of a concept of equal rights. And what we see now is a recapitulation of the same set of issues with respect to, and particularly with respect to the immigrant population. We did a conference at the school about a month and a half ago that dealt with the conditions along the border. And one thing that emerged very vividly from that discussion, and particularly from some people who came up who have lived in that region for a long time, is that what we are doing by building barriers on one side, on the Mexican, on the south side of the border region, and border checkpoints to the north side on the roads, is creating a militarized zone from which people cannot really effectively leave, and in which they're subject to a continual state of intimidation and fear, which disrupts the life of the community in very serious ways, in ways which are effectively violent. So that's the first point I want to make, is that this issue of state and statelessness is something which is not remote to us at all, but deeply embedded in our history. Now you ask, what about economic questions? Well, the first thing that comes to mind in thinking about that question is that this country, and it's true of wealthy industrialized countries generally, but this country in particular has a long history of absorbing resources from the rest of the world. And consuming, of course, at a much higher standard. That's what it means to be wealthy and industrialized. To defend that proportion of global resources is a task which is something which is characteristically approached with instruments of violent control. Right? And the fact that there are major parts of the world which are now emerging from a period, from a long historical period in which they did not compete with us for comparable shares of the world resources, is a major element in the kinds of potential violence that we see emerging in the world today. And this is something which we ought to be thinking about in a very serious way, because as the world becomes essentially a constellation of developed areas, there's not only a kind of deepening division between the rich and the poor, but also the potential for the reemergence of conflicts between the wealthy countries, which will be existential conflicts if they occur, because they will involve countries that are in the have the means of universal destruction at their disposal, including us. So we see this as the flashpoint at the moment. As of indeed this afternoon, is Korea, which launched a missile. The missile is more capable than previous missiles, but still doesn't have a reentry vehicle that could make it into an imminent threat. But it is a question where we are escalating the rhetoric, and if we're also going to be escalating the let's just say that everybody agrees that we, in doing so, we and the other side are running a very severe risk, and one which we would be well advised to try and actively seek a way of escaping from.
There's one thing I would push back on a little bit, is this notion that conflict is somehow over there. And there is certainly plenty of violent conflict happening in many parts around the world, thankfully not here in the United States in the way in which it takes place. But when I think about, for example, the police forces that descended on Ferguson, Missouri, and the militarized nature of police, the Humvees that were in civilian streets, the kinds of armor and weaponry that was deployed with civilian police. Police didn't always look like that, right? The way in which the New York Police Department, for example, began incorporating counterterrorism security procedures and intelligence procedures in the way in which they behaved throughout New York City and were treating the Muslim American population there has been well documented by the Associated Press and the New York Times. All of these things are a product of what is essentially a transnational security economy that has grown exponentially since the beginning of the war on terror, that the United States is heavily invested in, that partners of the United States, like Israel, are heavily invested in, and the returns of those investments are ending up on our streets and are curtailing our liberties and are building the walls on our borders in bigger and stronger and more technological ways. One of the companies that is in front now of a number of other contractors to build that wall is the Israeli company that built the wall in the West Bank and built a wall around the Gaza Strip. So there is an interconnectedness of all of these things, and even though there is lots of conflict over there, the results of that, we are also seeing that here. We're seeing that here in very troubling ways.
I'm glad you expounded upon that. I should have put it in air quotes when I said no violence over here, because I really didn't mean that we didn't have any violence over here. But I'm glad that you talked a little bit about that. And, you know, one thing I want to talk about, Jamie, I'll let you talk first before you answer. I'll ask the question. Jamie, you say whatever you want to say, and then we can answer this. But one thing I want to get to is the way in which you brought up earlier, nonviolence is also rejected as a form of rejecting oppression. So nonviolent forms of protest, including boycotting, are also not acceptable ways to understand yourself in this negotiation. So maybe talk a little bit about that eventually, but I don't want to interrupt what you were going to say.
I think there's a kind of ratchet effect in this security complex, and we have to think about whether there are ways to break out of a cycle of suspicion and security investments, which don't, in fact, improve our security and safety at all. I was talking a couple of days ago to an old friend of mine who was an aide to Vice President Johnson in the White House in the early 1960s, and then later to Vice President Humphrey. And he made the remark that back in those days, in the early 1960s, you could walk into the White House. It was not secured at all. Not just the executive office building, but the White House proper. And so this was essentially an open facility that the guards, there were guards, of course, but they recognized them. There was no identity check and so forth, and no checkpoints you had to go through. And when I went to work on Capitol Hill in the middle 1970s, it was completely open. Anybody could walk in, and he could walk into any congressman's office or any hearing. And there were guards, and maybe at some point there was a metal detector. That was it. There was no identity check or anything like that. The White House changed after Kennedy was assassinated. The Congress changed in 1981 when a bomb went off in a Senate cloakroom. And since that time, you can see these facilities, which were once open facilities, becoming increasingly basically fortresses. The same was true of embassies. I grew up a couple of years in the embassy in New Delhi, which was a magnificent, open, spacious facility. It's now an enclosed fortress that you can barely see from the street. And some of these things are obviously inevitable and necessary, but when you look at the sum and substance of it, you have the feeling of an arms race in the sense that the sides have escalated and escalated and that there's no greater security and certainly no greater sense of openness. Something is being lost, values of openness, of the free exchange of views, of unrestricted formation and expression of opinion, sort of acceptance of the legitimacy of the other person who's trying to participate in the public process. All of these things are being greatly, greatly diminished by what we're going through.